It is a good rule, wrote C.S. Lewis. After reading a new book, never allow yourself another new one till you have read an old one in between. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for the After Dinner Scholar podcast from Wyoming Catholic College. About 3 years ago, Dr. Jason Baxter taught the distance learning course, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, after which he turned his lectures into chapters for the book, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, How Great Books Shaped a Great Mind. We tend to forget that in addition to being a popular novelist and apologist, Lewis's day job was professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Oxford University and later at Cambridge University. That is, he was first and foremost a scholar, and his fiction and apologetic works are tied more tightly to his scholarship than most of his readers realize. I asked Dr. Baxter to begin by telling us when he first encountered C.S. Lewis.
I love that question. I think, like a lot of Protestant kids, grew up Protestant, Lewis is the philosopher. Lewis is, I think, to Protestant Christians what Aquinas is to Catholic Christians. And so I grew up reading him in high school. So at some point in high school, I remember I used to go to the local Barnes & Noble, right, when it was opened in Little Rock, and looked up at those sort of murals of the great authors and take my Lewis along with me and thought, now this is intellectual depth. And so I think, you know, Lewis was a deeply nourishing author for me, and loved his fiction, loved his nonfiction. But he's been with me since I was a teenager.
Now, one of your qualifications for writing this book is that you became an expert in the books that C.S. Lewis knew and read and loved and studied. How did that happen? Was that by design, or is that happy happenstance?
That was by complete accident or providence, depending on the perspective. No, I was working on Dante as a graduate student and trying to read the books that Dante read. And I read more and more of those books. And I thought I was getting weirder and weirder and more obscure. And then I started reading Lewis's nonfiction, not just his nonfiction, but his scholarly and academic works. And I was astonished that he had beat me to it on almost everything. And I think within the academic world, there's a weird kind of chronological snobbery built into it. You're sort of trained that if the book is older than 3 decades, it's probably not worth your time as a scholar. You need to stay up to date, and you need to cite works from 2019 if you want to keep your bibliography up to date. And so I think I just kind of absorbed this feeling that as a scholar, Lewis was no longer relevant. And that's, as for my personal life, I loved him and admired him, but I didn't think he'd have anything to say to my scholarly life. And then I discovered that he was reading all these things too. And he was reading weird things like Chalcedius and Jean de Meung and Bernard Silvestris and Alan of Lille, things which I thought I was bringing to the fore in my own little field of Dante studies. And then there was Lewis. But not just Lewis having identified them, Lewis had sat there and read them in manuscript form in libraries before they were translated, before they were even in proper edited editions, and he beat me to all of it. And so when I discovered that he and I were reading the same thing, then all of a sudden I think my eyes were opened to how much those old strange books, which we had both investigated as the background to Dante, also influenced everything else he wrote. And that was the huge surprise to me.
Well, you've got a chapter entitled Breathing Narnian Air. What do you mean by that?
I think I mean two things. The first thing I mean is that Lewis has an extraordinary respect for literature. He doesn't think it's superfluous, and nor does he think it's just ideas, philosophical or theological ideas, translated into story. He seems to think that literature engages a faculty of the mind and the heart and encounters those things in what he calls enjoyment as opposed to contemplation. He uses the image in his famous essay, Meditations in a Tool Shed, of walking into an old tool shed and there's a hole in the top of it and there's a little beam of light coming through it. And you can look at the beam of light as it's suspended in the dust. You can look at the beam, you can study it, you could count the dust particles if you had an instrument precise enough. But then you can also pivot and orient yourself so that beam of light falls right on your eye, in which case the beam disappears and you see where the beam comes from, another, the illuminated sky. And thus you could pivot back and forth, back and forth. Lewis, I think, does that as a scholar, but then he creates these imaginative fictional worlds that have weather, that have atmosphere, that have feeling, that ideas that get into the nerves and get into the pulses. That's what I mean by breathing Narnian air. And you can do it with respect to literature and with respect to ancient ideas. But Lewis thought that was crucial for Christianity because Christianity had become, I suppose, as always, to a certain extent, run the risk of, but especially in modernity, had run the risk of becoming a Sunday school religion, that Christianity is a set of correct opinions and a set of moral injunctions. And Lewis thought he could help Christianity by creating fictional worlds in which we could breathe it again, as opposed to just looking at it along, not just at.
Mm-hmm. You write that Lewis felt that the modern world was under what he called an evil enchantment. What is the evil enchantment, and why did Lewis believe medieval literature provided a counterspell?
The evil enchantment is what scholars would call the mechanization of the world picture. Our background picture, that the world outside of my mind is just a bunch of molecules colliding and interacting as if they're small parts and machines, small parts and gears in a machine. And thus, meaning is located within me, and matter outside of me is just dead, inert, material reality, waiting for it to be rearranged by me and my power tools. That's the evil enchantment. Because it's an evil enchantment because when you have that kind of world picture, you don't know if those stirrings and longings in your own heart, those spiritual inclinations toward worship and love, are just your brain cells as part of the great machine, or if they have reference to something beyond the world picture, a deeper spiritual reality. Thus, reading medieval literature for Lewis puts you almost kind of like therapy, puts you back in touch with those who believed in what we could call not a mechanistic world picture, but an iconic world picture that saw material reality as the spiritual world doing the best it could to manifest itself in physical space-time. It was a sacramental reality. It was a symbolic reality. And I think that's why Lewis adored his medieval books so much.
It's a sacramental imagination that it builds in us.
Right.
Now, I'd like you to talk about two major influences on Lewis, Boethius and Dante. Let's begin with Boethius. Why do you refer to Lewis as the new Boethius?
Yes, Lewis is the British Boethius. I think there are a lot of really neat parallels. First of all, Lewis tells his audiences, his own students, as recorded in the Discarded Image, that if you have a taste for Boethius, then you can virtually consider yourself a naturalized citizen of the Middle Ages. And that this was the book, as almost sort of the litmus test for which side of the great divide that you're on. He also, in a really interesting way, regularly refers to the world in which he lives as barbaric, as a new set of barbarians. Barbaric in the sense that it had lost connection with the classical past and was proud of it. Thus, I think that Lewis felt that he was living in something significantly analogous to the 6th century AD, when there was a classical culture which was crumbling, and a figure like Boethius, a man of learning, a man of languages, who tried to import as much as he could. But in these kinds of conditions, you don't have the luxury of being a pedantic scholar. What you try to do is preserve the general picture, the general portrait, how much they agreed with each other, everyone from Homer to Seneca to Dante. That, I think, is how Lewis thought of his work. Shoring up what is just about to be lost, getting the big picture, but also as a vernacularizer or a translator, just as Boethius translated from his works from Greek into Latin for his audience that was losing Greek, Lewis is kind of a cultural translator of translating things into modern, which were just about to be lost with a similar kind of invasion of barbarism.
Now, regarding Lewis and Dante, you write, Lewis felt Dante had a special value for the modern world. He provided the model for how to speak of spiritual realities in a way in which they felt real, attractive, and weighty.
Yeah, I think this was the original germ of the whole book, was the chapter on Dante. I gave it as a speech here at Wyoming Catholic College and then wrote it. But what it seems to me in Lewis's famous sermon, The Weight of Glory, there's both a biblical reference to a Pauline letter in there, but there seemingly is also a reference to the reading of Dante. There's a moment in Dante, I think it's Paradiso 25, in which Dante is being tested. And Dante says that he looks up at the apostles and feel that they were exerting and pressing a weight on him, the sort of weight of holiness, the weight of glory. And Lewis said that Dante couldn't have said that any better than by using that image, a sense of thickness, a sense of gravity, a sense of the heaviness of goodness. Now, Lewis also thought that most of the time when we think of spiritual or holiness or even heaven, our minds are so controlled by the negatives, that is, what those things, what we have to give up to earn those things, that it seems more like a loss than a gain. Thus, a great poet, and I think Lewis modeled himself on Dante in this respect, a great poet could make goodness feel weighty and attractive and desirable. And that, I think, is his greatest compliment to Dante, that Dante's Paradiso feels thick and heavy and doesn't make heaven this kind of ghostly, angelic phenomenon of angels strumming on, you know, citharas, right? Who wants to go there? But Dante rather did something which conveyed a sense of forcefulness of the weight of glory.
And you see that certainly in The Great Divorce, where the bus drives up to heaven.
Exactly, and I think even more so at the final reveal of The Great Divorce, that hell is this just little microscopic crack which George MacDonald has a hard time finding for his guide. Hell is just so tiny, and it felt so ample from within. And so I think that's a direct, it's Lewis being quite original and creative, but he's basically recycling this idea of finally liberating us from that ghostly, vague feeling with respect to our ultimate end.
Yeah, as Dante and Virgil descend into hell, it's got to get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that's good. It gets very claustrophobic toward the end, to the point that Dante has to do some spelunking, right, getting out of there. And it's an extremely nerve-wracking, claustrophobic experience.
Now, what are your hopes for the book? Is it possible to change our way of thinking so shaped by modernity's evil enchantment? And if so, or if not, how does your book, how do Lewis's books, how does the medieval literature that you and Lewis share change us?
I'm excited about the book. I think it's addressing a need right now. And I think in our world, I think your listeners, I think my students, the world is hungry for depth. And in our sort of fast food culture, we want something of deep nourishment. And I think one of the most interesting things that could happen from this book is to convince everyone to have a balanced diet of reading, as Lewis put it. It's the epigram to the introduction of going one to one. For every new book you read, read one old one. Or I have to tell my students here, for every old book you read, read one new one. But in some sense, going back and forth and constantly looking for a way to seek both weight and depth and interiority, as well as prudence and thinking through these kinds of issues, and how we can be holy and charitable and just in this particular age, while also having a sense of fidelity and piety to the past. I think Lewis provides a great paradigm for how to do that.
In his essay on the reading of old books, Lewis wrote, "Every age has its own outlook. It is specially good at seeing certain truths and specially liable to make certain mistakes. We all, therefore, need the books that will correct the characteristic mistakes of our own period. And that means the old books. Close quote. You can order a copy of Dr. Baxter's book, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, How Great Books Shaped a Great Mind, by going to his website, jasonmbaxter.com. That's jasonmbaxter.com. And he tells me he'll sign it as well. You can also access the Wyoming Catholic College distance learning course, The Medieval Mind of C.S. Lewis, and get a head start. The course is free, but we ask you to register at our website, wyomingcatholic.edu. That's wyomingcatholic.edu. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.